Laudator Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to our Vatican Weekend English feature program. I'm Susie Hodges and I'll be with you over the next half hour. Coming up on today's program, The Pope and the People. We have a report on Pope Francis's Wednesday General Audience, where he urges everyone to pray the Rosary asking God to put an end to violence, and he calls for greater care of the environment. 40 million and still counting. The Pope's Twitter accounts have reached a new milestone, with more than 40 million followers. The Hamletic Pope. On the third anniversary of his beatification, we revisit the figure of Pope Paul VI, who was described as baffling and brilliant by Newsweek magazine following his election to the papacy. And the restless gadabout who became a saint. We explore the life and personality of Saint Teresa of Avila, who for many years was unable even to pray after first entering her convent. We begin our programme with a report on Pope Francis's Wednesday General Audience on October the 11th, where he urged everyone to pray the Rosary for peace and call for greater care of the environment and action to prevent natural disasters. Philippa Hitchin reports.
Noting that Friday marks the International Day for the Reduction of Natural Disasters, Pope Francis appealed to public officials and institutions to protect the environment and help prevent natural disasters. The Pope urged those in authority to promote a culture of care for creation, as well as taking concrete steps to defend our common home and to protect its most vulnerable inhabitants. Friday the 13th, the Pope noted, also marks the closing of centenary celebrations for the last Marian apparitions to the shepherd children in Fatima, Portugal. He invited everyone to pray the Rosary throughout this month of October, asking God to soften even the hardest of hearts, to put an end to violence and to build a more peaceful world.
Oggi vorrei soffermarmi.
During his continuing reflections on Christian hope this week, Pope Francis talked about the attitude of attentive waiting. Just as Jesus tells his disciples to be like those who await the return of their master with lamps alight, he said Christians must always be attentive, awaiting the Lord's return. Every day is a new opportunity to be attentive to God, the Pope continued, to welcome the day as his gift and to live that day by offering our good works to him. Such attentiveness requires patience, he said, yet no night is so long as to make us forget the joy that comes with the dawn. As Christians, the Pope concluded, we know that no matter what we may suffer, life has its purpose and the merciful Lord will greet us at its end. Thus we can look upon history and upon our own lives with confidence and hope, he added, knowing that the future is not guided solely by the work of our hands, but by God's providence. I'm Philippa Hitchin.
Pope Francis's Twitter accounts have reached a new milestone with more than 40 million followers across 9 different languages. A Vatican statement said the various @Pontifex accounts have gained 9 million new followers over the past year alone. The announcement came just a few months before the 5th anniversary of when Pope Benedict XVI launched the initiative by sending the first papal tweet on the microblogging site. The Holy Father's Spanish Twitter account has the most followers, closely followed by English. Chris Altieri tells us more about the significance of this new milestone on Twitter.
The figure is significant not only in itself, but in what it represents for the Holy Father himself, who, like his predecessor, desires to be a Christian witness among many in the digital continent, especially through social media. Alessandro Gisotti spoke to the prefect of the Secretariat for Communication, Monsignor Dario Eduardo Viganò, who is entrusted with the coordination of the papal accounts on Twitter and Instagram.
Molto differenti dai discorsi ufficiali agli incontri a braccio, appunto ai caratteri di Twitter.
40 million followers means 40 million people, 40 million hearts, minds, and passions, said Monsignor Vigano. It is a world, a relationship, a community. This figure emphasizes that so many people continue to follow day after day, even by way of 140-character bursts, the Pope's magisterium, which reaches people in different ways, from official speeches to unscripted encounters to Twitter characters. Asked about the Holy Father's social media presence more specifically, especially on Twitter and Instagram, where Pope Francis shares photos and videos under his @Franciscus handle, Monsignor Vigano said the Pope takes great care of his social profiles, to such an extent that he closely and carefully checks all the tweets which are then published.
Il Papa ha molta cura dei suoi profili social, a tal punto che controlla minuziosamente tutti i Twitter che poi vengono pubblicati.
He went on to say, this concern speaks to the Pope's care for relationships. So the Pope, who calls himself a grandfather, who claims to be far from new technologies, nevertheless intuits that there is a world, the social media world, that is made up of people. Monsignor Vigano also said, the Church is born when the Holy Spirit overwhelms the disciples and opens the doors of the upper room, and they take to the streets of the world. Today, among those streets are the so-called social communities. That is why the Pope is very attentive to this reality, because any relationship needs care, which is to say, cor urat, that is, to warm the heart, even through a few letters.
C'è un esempio, un modello che può dare il Papa anche in questo momento affinché internet.
Gisotti asked whether Pope Francis can be taken as an example of how to use social media so that the internet is a network not of wires but of people, as he himself wrote in his first message for the World Day of Social Communications.
Sì, questo appunto raccoglie anche l'eredità del Papa.
Yes, responded Monsignor Vigano. This also collects the inheritance of Pope Emeritus Benedict XVI, who has made some very interesting speeches on the net. I believe that the further step, the one we might summarize as from the click to the heart, is to imagine a community of believers who leave traces of the allure of the gospel of mercy even on the net. I'm Chris Altieri.
In a recent report on Twitter by Twiplomacy.com, which ranks world leaders' impact on the social media platform, the Pope's accounts had the second most followers among world leaders, only some 200,000 followers behind the US President Donald Trump. Twiplomacy ranked the Pope as coming in third among world leaders, with the most interactions and being the most influential because of his average of 41,000 retweets. Earlier on in his papacy, the Holy Father would publish two or three tweets each week, usually snippets from homilies or speeches. More recently, he tweets almost daily. It's often a call to work for peace or a short reflection on a saint. And his tweet on October the 11th recalled the feast day of one of his predecessors. Like St. John the 23rd, whom we remember today, let us witness to God's goodness and mercy before the Church and the world. And staying on the theme of social media, the Pope is set to hit another milestone soon by notching up 5 million followers on Instagram, the photo-sharing site. His account at Franciscus was set up in March 2015. The majority of Instagram followers are from the ages of 25 to 34, with the United States and Brazil being the countries where it is most followed. Pope who could and did quote from Shakespeare's Hamlet. Paul VI was described as both baffling and brilliant by Newsweek magazine in an editorial following his election. Born Giovanni Montini in the town of Brescia in northern Italy, Paul VI reigned from 1963 to 1978. He was beatified 3 years ago by Pope Francis on October the 19th, 2004. Veronica Scaresbrick looks back at the reign of this 20th century Pope with the help of sound from Vatican Radio's archives.
The press which you represent can be a most important instrument of great good. Always be faithful to the truth. That is the question.
That is the question. The words of Pope Paul VI provoked hilarity and clapping among the journalists gathered around him. They understood that reference to Hamlet's famous soliloquy. It was December 1964, and during an impromptu press conference, the Pope unleashed an unusual self-deprecating sense of humour, showing an awareness of a specific journalistic quirk, that of repeatedly reporting a quote likening him to this most famous of Shakespearean characters. It's a familiar story going back to the days when Pope Paul was still Cardinal Archbishop Montini of Milan and the Roman Pontiff his predecessor John the 23rd. Said Pope John, inquiring after the Cardinal in his home diocese of Milan, "Well, how's your Hamlet Cardinal?" A shrewd remark, never to be forgotten by the press, resurfacing when the Cardinal Archbishop of Milan was himself elected to the See of Peter in June 1963. And not just in the local press. Even the Newsweek issue marking Paul VI's recent election to the papacy, which sported his photograph still dressed as a cardinal on the cover, quoted it. Running an editorial by the title of "We Have a Pope, Paul VI, Baffling Brilliant," only a few lines down, there was an entire paragraph dedicated to the Hamlet Cardinal.
Cardinal Montini, at a more searching look, is a baffling figure both in person and in politics. Although he was the first prelate whom Pope John elevated to cardinal, the uncomplicated John apparently had ambivalent feelings about the intellectual Montini.
And Papa Montini was indeed an intellectual, a man at ease in literary circles, familiar with Shakespeare, having visited Stratford-on-Avon 3 decades earlier. As he himself once explained in the exclusive recording in English you're about to hear, "A word of warning, don't be misled by the royal we, dictated by the papal protocol of the time."
Pope Paul was speaking about himself.
"The visit we made about 30 years ago as an inquiring and hasty tourist to the city and the home of Shakespeare in Stratford of Avon, with the impression of fantastic riches and psychological truth."
The impression of fantastic riches and psychological truth, said Pope Paul, speaking on the occasion of celebrations for the 4th centenary of the birth of Shakespeare. It was 1964. Among his audience, directors and actors of the Royal Stratford Theatre, exceptionally performing in Rome, just down the road from St. Peter's.
"The commemoration is particularly adapted to Rome. Always savvy and prompt as she is, honor the high achievements of the human spirit, and happy today to celebrate in this supreme writer the magnificent cultural tradition and artistic genius of the English people."
Shakespeare's writings, Paul VI stressed, were profoundly human, ever open to adventurous and poetic exploration, leading to the discovery of moral laws which make life great and sacred.
God exists. There is a life after this life. Evil doing is punished and good rewarded.
Clearly, for Pope Paul VI, genius and faith could go hand in hand.
He believed Shakespeare's lofty genius and powerful language would induce humankind to listen with great reverence to the great truths expounded in his works. Perhaps that affinity to Hamlet constantly attributed to him, stemming from his apparent inability to merely brush aside the daunting difficulties in his personal quest for truth, may not have displeased him altogether. But why not listen then to that famous soliloquy?
To be or not to be, that is the question. Whether it is nobler in the mind to suffer the slings and arrows of outrageous fortune, or to take arms against a sea of troubles, and by opposing, end them.
In the twilight years of his 15-year pontificate, Paul VI may have fleetingly remembered John XXIII's remarks while jotting down a series of notes.
"What is my state of mind?" he wrote. "Am I Hamlet or Don Quixote? On the left, on the right, I don't feel I have properly been understood." Who knows whether or not he was understood as Pope? What's certain is that the man to inherit from his predecessor to the papacy a council it is said he would never have called was a prudent and far-sighted man who avoided those kind of decisions where another would have acted first and reflected later.
And many thanks there to Veronica Scaresbrick for that feature on Blessed Paul VI. She's a doctor of the church and one of the world's greatest mystics, but began her life a long way from sainthood and was once described as a restless and disobedient gadabout. St. Teresa of Avila, whose feast day falls on October the 15th, was for many years unable even to pray when she first entered a Carmelite convent as a young woman. In this special programme, Jill Bevilacqua looks back at the life and personality of Teresa of Avila, who's also known as St. Teresa of Jesus.
Doña Teresa de Cepeda Ahumada was born in Avila, Spain, on March 28, 1515. The child of well-born parents, she grew up in one of those palacios or mansions which can still be seen in Avila today. Later, Teresa used the image of these palaces to describe what she believed a contemplative convent should be, a fortress manned with a chosen company of the king's soldiers.
And in her masterpiece, Interior Castle, she wrote, "I began to think of the soul as if it were a castle made of a single diamond or a very clear crystal, in which there are many rooms, just as in heaven there are many mansions."
Teresa's mother died when she was 13, and after a stormy adolescence, she entered the Carmelite convent of the Incarnation. Teresa was afraid of marriage, and 16th century Spain offered no alternative but the cloister. A life of purgatory, Teresa reasoned, would mean an eternity of joy.
When we think of Teresa today, we tend to visualize the final product, the mystic and the saint. But the young woman who passed through the convent door on that chill November morning in 1536 was a long way from sainthood. For many years, she was unable even to pray, as she herself tells in her life story.
"I suffered great affliction when I tried to pray. For my spirit, instead of being master, was slave. I was unable to shut myself within myself, without at the same time shutting in 1,000 irrelevances. Often I was more taken up with wishing away my hour of prayer and listening whenever the clock struck, than in thinking good thoughts. Again and again, I would have chosen any severe penance that might be imposed on me, rather than have to practice recollection as a preparation to prayer. I found neither joy in God nor satisfaction in the world. When I was caught up in the pleasures of the world, I was unhappy in recalling what I owed to God. When I was with God, I was restless, craving for what the world had to offer. I passed almost 20 years on this storm-tossed sea. But I realized that by this time it was no longer possible to give up prayer. He who desired me for himself held me in his hand. And I realized the greatness of God's compassion for me. For while I was still entangled with the affairs of the world, he gave me the courage to pray.
Teresa spent 26 years in the Incarnation Convent, a hurly-burly of a place, she called it. 150 women lived in this fashionable convent, where the much-mitigated rule allowed nuns to come and go as they chose, where visitors were frequent and gossip was rife. Teresa herself was drawn for a time into the superficial friendships of the convent parlour, but she gradually tired of this shallow kind of life, and at the age of 43, the idea of the reform came to her.
In 1562, Teresa founded the first convent where those so disposed could live according to the primitive rule of the Carmelites, in the spirit of the original hermits of Mount Carmel, consecrated to silence and contemplative prayer. But though she scaled the mystical heights, Teresa was very down to earth in her approach to prayer.
When I see someone trying to work out what kind of prayer they are practicing, and are so engrossed in prayer that they are afraid, apparently, to move an inch or spare a moment's thought for fear they be deprived to the slightest degree of the devotion they are enjoying, I realize how little they know about the road to union with God. They think that this is the whole thing. Well, it isn't. Not at all. What the Lord wants is works. If you see someone sick to whom you can bring help, don't imagine your devotions will suffer. Have compassion. If she is in pain, try to share her pain. If need be, go without food so that she may have yours.
In the 20 years that followed the foundation of the first reformed convent, until her death in 1582, Teresa was to found 16 more convents. She faced considerable opposition, was denounced from the pulpit, and described as a restless, contumacious, disobedient gadabout. Since she had to make her foundations in person and be on the spot to resolve problems, she was constantly on the move.
And yet this nun, while living a life of exceptional activity, was dedicated to silence and contemplation and became one of the world's greatest mystics. Her writings on prayer have never been surpassed. She was asked to write on prayer for the nuns of her own convent. Like Teresa in her early years as a nun, they found prayer difficult, but she protested.
Why do they want me to write things? Let learned men who have studied do the writing. There are more than enough books written on prayer already. For the love of God, let me work at my spinning wheel and go to choir and perform the duties of the religious life like the other sisters. I am not meant to write. I have neither the health nor the wits for it.
But Teresa did have the wits, and her words were wise and full of common sense.
Why do we use so many words, she said, when the petitions contained in the Our Father cover all our needs, spiritual and temporal? From foolish devotions may God defend us.
Teresa also gives clear directives to those who have to deal with religious of a nervous kind.
Superiors should not, in general, allow nuns who are neurotic to spend long stretches of time at prayer. Usually, the imagination of such persons is their weak point, and too much prayer only does harm. Besides, they get extraordinary ideas which neither they themselves nor others who hear of such goings-on can possibly understand.
Much has been said about St. Teresa's mystical experiences. She herself was frequently embarrassed by them, especially when she had raptures in public. As for their significance, she was categorical and advised others to be wary of mystical phenomena.
Though some such phenomena may be genuine, I'm sure it is best to regard them of no importance. God guides some people in one way, some in another. And this particular path is not the one which leads to the greatest sanctity. Progress in the spiritual life has nothing to do with consolations granted during prayer, nothing to do with raptures, visions and the like, the value of which we cannot estimate until we reach the world to come.
In her interior castle, Teresa asks her readers, who were her co-sisters, what they think God's will is, and answers that they should be perfect and be one with him. She goes on.
The Lord asks two things of us. Love of God and love of our neighbour. If we want to know whether we are keeping these commandments, we must discover, I believe, whether we genuinely love our neighbour. For we cannot be sure if we are loving God, whereas we can know if we love our neighbour. Ask the Lord to give you this perfect love for others. Allow him to work within you. If you do your best to fulfill this in every way you can, he will give you more than you can desire.
Finally, Teresa suggests that as regards mental prayer, it's a question of a relationship between friends. That is her own experience, and she says, I can speak of what I have experience of.
Mental prayer, in my opinion, is nothing else than an intimate sharing between friends. It means taking time frequently to be alone with him whom we know loves us. In order that love be true and the friendship endure, the wills of the friends must be in accord. The will of the Lord, it is already known, cannot be at fault. Our will is vicious, sensual, and ungrateful. And if you do not yet love him as he loves you, because you have not reached the degree of conformity with his will, you will endure this pain of spending a long while with one who is so different from you, whose friendship is of such immense benefit, and who loves you so much.
Teresa of Avila died at Alba de Tormes on October the 4th, 1582. She was canonized by Pope Gregory the 15th 40 years later. And on October the 15th, 1967, Pope Paul the 6th declared her a Doctor of the Church.
Teresa's death, this prayer was found in her breviary.
Be thou by naught perturbed, of naught afraid, for all things pass save God, who does not change. Be patient, and at last thou shalt of all fulfillment find. Hold God, and naught shall fail thee, for he alone is all.
And many thanks there to Jill Bevilacqua for that programme about St. Teresa of Avila. And that's all we have time for today. Thanks for joining us here on Vatican Radio. And don't forget you can listen to our programmes at any time by checking out our website on en.radiovaticana.va. That's en.radiovaticana.va. I'm Susie Hodges, and until next time, Laudato Jesus Christus.